Welcome to Season 3 of The Bonner Breakdown. The Bonner Breakdown is here to have conversations, to create connection, and find things to celebrate. So get your mug ready. We are going to celebrate the good report and give a cheers to the good report. In today's episode with Mayor Shelby Rungstad, we will talk about a lot of controversial topics. So buckle your seatbelt, enjoy the conversation, and feel free to interact on social media at Bonner Breakdown. Enjoy the show. All right, welcome to the Bonner Breakdown. It's Chris. I'm here with Mayor Shelby. Shelby, it's good to have you on the program again.
Pleasure to be here, Chris, and hello to all your viewers.
Yeah, awesome. Awesome. Well, you know, the viewers are growing. I almost said the growers are vowing. Hang on, I need more coffee. I just totally mixed that up. You know, we start every single show with a good report. Mm-hmm. We want to hear something that's good news from whatever's happening either in your world or something with the city. Do you have anything for a good report?
Yeah, I think so. First of all, I'll say congratulations to the class of 2020.
Come on, class of 2020.
That was exciting. You know, it seems like it's been pretty difficult to find things to celebrate about recently, and you know, being called to attention in my house, hearing the honks and cheers as the high school kids and their families were mm-hmm. driving through downtown last Saturday was really cool.
So that's awesome.
Yeah, it felt good, and we went out and went out on the street and enjoyed that. So congratulations to that class. And last council meeting, the city council approved the site-specific plans for the Parks and Rec Master Plan, which is really cool because we've been working on that. It's been a community-driven master planning effort, which is part of the most robust master planning effort that the city's ever undertaken. We've got many master plans underway. The Parks and Rec Plan is one of them, and it's been, you know, we've been working on it for about a year, mm-hmm. and just this last council meeting, we passed the site-specific plans, which is the city beach, the downtown waterfront, and the sports complex, which is Traverse and Centennial Park. So we've had, you know, great public participation through that, and we've created a fantastic vision for the future of Sandpoint, and I'm really excited to move into that next phase, which will be implementation. So
cool.
Yeah.
No, that's great. That's great. And, you know, I like being able to see progress being made on some of these plans because it just gives us clarity on what's next. Mm-hmm. You know, some people get stuck in planning their whole life and nothing ever happens. So it's good to see the city moving forward on plans. That's been really good. And it's been fun being part of the, you know, the city's comprehensive planning portion dealing with the housing side of things. Mm-hmm. So it's been a pleasure to be a part of that. You know, speaking about the graduates, it's been really, I think that the local media has done just a great job of highlighting the seniors this year with COVID-19, with the whole not having a regular graduation and being able to highlight either through signs in the yard or, mm-hmm. You know, driving through downtown and the different things that have happened to celebrate them. Mm-hmm. I've enjoyed seeing how many students are receiving scholarships. And I love seeing that those are being highlighted in the media publicly, mm-hmm. Not just like a byline, but they're doing whole stories on kids or students, you know, getting their, you know, information out there. So I just have been really impressed with that. You know, in a season where we forget to celebrate the good, to see these seniors getting celebrated mm-hmm. for their achievements has been really, really awesome. So that's a good report. Thank you for yours. Cheers.
Cheers.
All right. Cheers to the good report.
Way to go, students of 2020.
2020 class of 2020. Student, class of 2020. Awesome. Good job, guys. So awesome. So Shelby, I asked you to come on because, you know, about 7 months ago, you and I sat here and I actually cut out about 40 minutes of conversation that we had because we were just introducing this show. And we're kind of in a place now of really opening the doors a little bit wider for a broader conversation in the community. And that 40-minute conversation was specifically around some ideology and race stuff and things that are just paramount in society on the news. It's everywhere today. Mm-hmm. And I said, hey, let's come back and have that conversation, mm-hmm. you know, again, publicly. It's one of the things that I do appreciate tremendously about you is your openness to have conversation. There's a lot of people that aren't willing to have a conversation. And it seems like you've done very well at being able to listen. You know, there's a lot of differing opinions about you publicly, which you're very, you know, aware of. And would love to hear a little bit about how this season has gone for you. Kind of what's happened. You know, I mean, anybody who lives in Sandpoint is on Facebook or reads the Bee or the Reader or whatever should be fairly up to speed that there's been after the George Floyd killing, there has been a tremendous level of angst and anxiety across all of the major cities in America. And mm-hmm. it did not escape North Idaho. I've got some pretty interesting stories as well that we'll probably get into from friends who live in major cities. You know, it is a difficult issue. Racism is a difficult issue up here, I think, specifically in North Idaho, for probably not all the reasons that we wish it was. Mm-hmm. And so how's that been going for you? What's your process been like? The floor is yours.
Yeah, boy, I could go on for the next few hours. This has been really a pretty remarkable time. And I think, you know, this kind of caught everybody by surprise. Yeah. Certainly with what happened with George Floyd, we've seen that time and time again in this country, you know, mm-hmm. for the entire history of this country, but really, you know, highlighted in the media many times over these last number of years. Mm-hmm. I'd say the last 5 years, we've just seen, you know, there was a period there in 2014 to 2016, it seemed mm-hmm. like, where it seemed like every 2 weeks there was an incident like that
yep.
somewhere around the country.
Yep.
And you know, of course, people are outraged mm-hmm. and it caught media attention and there were some marches on the street, but nothing like what we've been seeing this last 2 weeks. And I think that, you know, what that tells me, and I'm sure this is obvious to everyone out there, is we're really, I think, at a turning point.
I agree.
And this yep. is, I think it was, you know, this was the straw that broke the camel's back, so mm-hmm. to speak. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you could attribute it to a lot of things. There's a lot going on right now. You know,
this is not a simplistic issue. It's very complex.
That's right.
Yeah.
But I think one significant contributing factor is that we've been undergoing the COVID pandemic.
Uh-huh.
You know, stay at home orders, and that has really just thrown our society into a flux in a way that you know, we've never experienced in generations yeah. in this yeah. country. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, with that, you have a lot of people unemployed, mm-hmm. a lot of people with a lot of free time on their mm-hmm. hands who are extremely frustrated. Mm-hmm. And once again, you know, it's those marginalized mm-hmm. who are most impacted by the pandemic.
Yeah. And that goes across socioeconomic factors in a ton of different directions.
That's right.
But it does include race as well.
So, that's yeah. right. Yeah, well said. Yeah. And so I think this was, you know, the tensions were already so high. There was already so much angst around mm-hmm. racism, around structural racism in our society, around mm-hmm. inequity, around mm-hmm. Economic injustice. Mm-hmm. And then, so the ground was ripe for an event like this to come along and really just push everybody yeah. over the edge. And,
yeah. Yeah.
and I was surprised to see, you know, like wildfire, these riots and marches, mm-hmm. I should say marches and in some yeah. cases riots across
yeah.
the country.
Yeah.
But you know, I think what was really shocking for many of us is what happened here in Sandpoint and other small towns across America.
Yeah. yeah. Sandpoint's not isolated in this process. Yeah.
It is, and I'm referring to, and of course everyone has been on social media probably in the last week and has seen all the chatter, but for instance, I did a post, I think it was last Wednesday, it was after the Tuesday night, mm-hmm. You know, march downtown, which was the first, it was the first Black Lives Matter march, I think it was the first one in Sandpoint for this event, and there was, you know, I'd say roughly 50 armed citizens that that came downtown and you know made their presence. And these were, you know, not just like a concealed, you know, sidearm, you know, pistol. This was AR-15s and full body gear. So that it was quite a presence. And, you know, I think for many people, it was, you know, who haven't served in the military, it's probably the most guns they've ever seen in one place at one time. And it wasn't, you know, it wasn't a military, it wasn't a police force. These were just citizens out there armed. So, so I think that was pretty shocking for a lot of people. It first happened, I think, on Monday night. It happened in Coeur d'Alene. That was the first that I'd heard about, and then it came here. And then just in the last few days, I've seen a couple of news reports come out on national media. There was a BuzzFeed article. There was a Daily KO that came out this morning. Both featured this movement across the country in rural communities like ours. And so it's actually encouraging for me to see like, oh, okay, this wasn't an isolated incident in North Idaho.
Yeah.
This is happening across the country. So at least it, it feels like, oh, okay, we're kind of all in this together. And there's, there's somehow some comfort in that. And you know, we can dive as deep as you want to go into this, but yeah, I made a post on Wednesday and I was really concerned because one thing that was obvious to me, I came down and I participated with the students. It was, I would say probably 85 or 90% students
who were
marching.
Pretty young
people. And there was, you know, maybe 100 to 150. I came sort of late in the march, so I think a lot of people had peeled away. So there was maybe only 100 at that point, but I marched with these kids, and in the process, I also stopped and talked to several of the armed citizens. And so I was trying to, you know, get as much of a perspective of, of what was going on down there as possible.
What were you hearing from the armed citizens in that process?
You know, I had a great conversation with one man, and, you know, he told me, you know, and this is what I heard from several of them was that, you know, kind of their calling card was, or their mantra was, our Second Amendment protects your First Amendment. And so, I heard that, and I heard that many of them were concerned about, you know, looting and rioting that had happened elsewhere in the country, and were, you know, had heard a rumor on social media.
There's some agitators coming up and that kind of thing.
And so, they wanted to protect our community and our businesses. So I thought, you know, and I can appreciate that intent, you know, and that's that conversation that we had 7 months ago where we got, we weren't able to fit it all in. You know, we talked a lot about racism and about power dynamics. And a lot of what this comes down to for me and the way that I've been able to understand it best is a difference between intent and impact. And for me, you know, I always, you know, often we have good intent and I always try, you know, of course we all want to be good people and we intend well.
I think across the board, that's a good rule to keep in mind.
That's right. That's right.
You know, like, no matter who you're talking to, that most people aren't malicious.
That's right.
You know, so it's good. Yeah.
And if there is somebody out there who has ill intent in their heart, then it's good to know that too.
Yeah, it is.
And good to identify that, call it out.
okay, so let's stop real quick though, because this is where it gets interesting, because a lot of people have such high bias, political bias, that anyone who doesn't agree with their political agenda is already attributed with ill intent. And I think you see that across the board. And I think the media plays on that to sell ads and to get clicks and everything else. So the hyper division that I'm seeing politically is often driven by mind reading of ill intent into people's hearts, where that may or may not be there. But the disagreement often turns into ill intent, an assumption of ill intent. So that's just a little side note of what I observe. You know, when I've been in situations where people have attributed ill intent to me for whatever reason. And I always have to step back from that and go, okay, they don't know me. They don't have context. Mm-hmm. They don't, they're making an assumption. And then usually at that point, I'm okay. All right. They don't know, you know, like, all right, they're going to see what they want to see. Mm-hmm. At that point, I see it happening across the board everywhere. So that's a, that's just when you talk about that, that concept of how do we know, right? How do mm-hmm. we know if somebody has ill intent? Well, we have to take them at their words. Mm-hmm. And usually some people's words are very, very hurtful and definitely has ill intent, mm-hmm. you know? So just my two cents on that.
Yeah, no, I appreciate you saying that. And that was one thing that I saw is there seemed to be both at play there.
Yeah.
And I did speak with people who clearly they had the best of intentions, that evening. And then I also, heard from one in particular, and I saw actions, that clearly to me, in my mind, mm-hmm. demonstrated, you know, ill intent.
Yeah. And there were some horrific, things that were posted on Facebook and
that's right.
you know, things like that, that you're like, that's painful to see.
Yeah.
In our community. Period. Right. But
yeah. Yep. Facebook, the land of trolls, where it can really get out of hand. And yeah. I think you're right. There, you know, that's where people really kind of, you know, show where they're at.
Yeah.
Because they're
they believe anonymity gives them a little bit more courage.
Yeah. But even though they're not anonymous.
They're not. Yeah. It's crazy.
Anyway, so one thing that, you know, became clear to me through that Tuesday evening and just witnessing that whole thing, you know, I got a number of people contacted me and on social media and texts and whatnot, and mm-hmm. and we're just concerned about, yeah. oh my God, what's happening in our community? Mm-hmm. And this is, you know, felt like a militarized zone down there. It felt like we were in some, you know, like Rwanda or something, you know, somewhere where you see military or yeah. you know, people who aren't even military, but just, you know, armed people mm-hmm. in the streets. And, mm-hmm. and it's, you know, that's not how, we are used to being. It's not normal in the United States of America. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there was, while I was there, there was, three girls that came up to me at this march, and this was at the end. And they were concerned to go home because, and they were asking for help. And these are, you know, 16 to 18 year old girls.
Yep. Yep.
And they had been, you know, photographed and there was, and I actually have on video, there was a group that was taking license plate numbers of protesters, and, you know, photographing their license plates and that kind of thing. And then one of those people from one of those armed citizens was following these three girls as they drove away, and they got scared and came back, and at that point that's when they, you know, connected with me,
uh-huh.
and we had a conversation with the police chief and okay. he encouraged them to call 911 and uh-huh. Just to have it, you know, registered in yep. that way.
Okay.
And so, you know, that's the kind of example yeah. of, you yeah. know, intimidation and harassment uh-huh. that,
probably not necessary,
not necessary. Point. Right. And so, yeah. you know, again, this, I mean, we can break this down all kinds of ways mm-hmm. and I'm sure we'll continue talking about this intent versus impact. But, you know, one thing from the police side that's clear to me after going through this is, you know, the job of the police is to prevent people from breaking the law and, mm-hmm. you know, we give them as much discretion as we can, and they try to just sort of, you know, be a good citizen yeah. and encourage people to be good citizens. But in terms of, you know, protecting people from harm, mm-hmm. You know, unless somebody's broken a law, there isn't really anything that they can do there yep. other than just have a conversation with mm-hmm. somebody.
And so the police should not be reading minds either.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right. And so, but this is what, you know, where it became obvious to me that there's an issue here that it isn't an issue that can be addressed with the police force. And that correct. Is that, yeah. that there was a lot of behavior that was happening there that wasn't technically illegal. It wasn't illegal. Even that, you know, what I would call harassment and intimidation doesn't go to the level of mm-hmm. illegal behavior. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, certainly, you know, having, you know, a full arsenal of weapons, you know, down on Second Avenue isn't illegal.
It's not.
You know, Second Amendment rights are.
And Idaho is one of the most conservative states in that regard.
That's right.
Yeah.
But there is a difference between what is respectful, mm-hmm. responsible behavior, mm-hmm. And what I would say what is ethical, mm-hmm. and what is illegal.
So, what do you think? What do you think? You know, when you look at the situation, what do you think happened to make a group of people say we need our guns downtown because there's a Black Lives Matter march? Do you feel like that's driven by, like, what's the driver there?
That's a good question. I think for
not that you can read minds, but what's your
thank you?
I'm not asking you to deal with the intent issue from the standpoint of knowing it, but
right.
what's your idea? What's going on
right.
with that?
Yeah, well, I think it's a couple things. One, I think there is legitimate, real fear that is pervasive in our society. And, mm-hmm. you know, we are in the midst of a changing, there's so much change going right now. And we're not talking about, you know, this moment in time. Well, we are talking about this moment in time, but this has been something that has been building, you know, through human history, frankly. This is, it really is something. And certainly for, you know, there's all kinds of ways that we can look back and mark it and, mm-hmm. and mark how this
there's some watershed moments throughout history that are worth celebrating and amazing, and there's watershed moments of great tragedy, like you said, these moments in time that we mark it. Go ahead.
Right But you know, I can talk about a few mm-hmm. of these that I sort of see right now, and one is just this changing the changing demographics of our nation. We'll be the first majority white nation that at some point in the near future the white will no longer be the demographic
Correct.
Majority.
Yeah.
So that just shows how much change is happening in the mm-hmm. demographics of not just our nation. This is happening across the world, right?
Yeah.
We see global travel.
Yeah.
And immigration,
yep.
and you know, cross-cultural and cross-ethnic, you know, marriage and cultural mixing and all this stuff. So, and this has obviously been going on for generations. So it's just, you know, it's coming to a point where it's having a wholesale change in just what our makeup is as a society.
Yeah,
and then you add to that the economic change that has been underway and continues, and of course that's driven by technology. It's driven by globalization.
What are you talking
politics.
About in the change in the economics? What are you referencing? What type of change?
You know, from I mean, we could talk about a lot of things. You know, energy, for example. You know, we've gone. You know, there's been this movement away from cultural movement away from non-renewables.
Right.
Coal is a great example. I mean, you go back two generations and
Absolutely.
Know, a significant percentage of the population was working in either, you know, agriculture mm-hmm. or energy in mm-hmm. mining
mm-hmm.
And the timber. Right. So all of those,
those things have shifted. Yeah.
Those things that, you know, massive shift. And so now we have this destabilization in terms of economic, you know, opportunity and employment,
mm-hmm.
That is just dramatically affects, our outlook for the future.
Yeah.
And, you know, growing up in generations in a farming community or in a farming family or, you know, I had grandparents, my grandfather and his brothers all grew up working in the mine and down in Silver Valley.
Okay. Yeah.
And that was their,
'cause you're fourth generation Idaho.
That's right.
Right. Yeah.
As much as people out there want to say I'm from California and go back to where you came from.
Yeah.
And,
you grew up.
Ironically, at least half of them are from California.
Yeah. Well, but you grew up in Lewiston, right?
That's right.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So I have a firsthand experience of you know what that was like, and then of course, you know, they worked in the my grandfather worked at Potlatch for a while in the mill, so you know, that was, you know, the majority of Idaho economy was either agriculture, mining, or mm-hmm. forestry for it's history,
right?
You know, as long as the white man was here anyway.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then it's just been in the last generation that is just totally turned on its head.
Yep.
And, you know, even when I moved to Sandpoint just 20 years ago, and there were two lumber mills in town. Now there's zero.
Yep. Right? Yeah.
There's a lot of places we could go here, but the bottom line is that
I'll go ahead and finish that.
It's just that, you know, with that shift and nobody's to blame for this. It's because of technology. It's because of culture.
Absolutely. Right.
But there's, you know, in that there's winners and there's losers. There's people who've had generations in, let's say in forestry or in mining or whatever it is. And now they're destabilized. Now what do I do?
Yep.
You know?
Yep.
And at the same time, the opportunities that college and education are sort of conventional 4-year degree program used to offer doesn't guarantee you the kind of employment or employment opportunities economic advantages.
The education piece used to get you used to guarantee an upper level, you know, income, but because so many people have degrees, that has, you know, it's just flooded the market almost, you know, it's just that the supply and demand issue with the degree, it's not worth as much, you know, as we wished it would be.
I think that's absolutely true. But I also think that, that we've had a decoupling from, what education actually offers in terms of, applicable,
skill sets
for the current job market.
Yep.
And, you know, where the business, where the economy is really is at and what the needs are.
Yeah.
And
there's a huge difference.
Yeah.
I was having a conversation with a couple of people from New York and, you know, younger, and they have a socialism degree and a,
sociology.
I'm sorry. Did I say that out loud? Sociology degree.
And they're Antifa,
No, they're not Antifa. I think they probably would be, prone to...
We should talk about that.
Yeah, we will. So they have a socialism degree, and the other one has a social work degree. Uh-huh. So all my socials got mixed up. So with that, they can't find anything that's going to pay for their loans.
Yeah.
They can't find any job that's going to pay for those. And part of that is... getting a degree in that field is basically like, okay, well, I have a degree that, you know, and that's basically all they can show up with is like, I have a degree, unless they find something in that field. And you have to start at the bottom and put in a lot of work to get to a high paying job in those fields. So they're frustrated, you know, now that they're out of college and what they thought they were going to do, it's not possible.
Yeah.
So on the education side, that's a tough one. So the demographics have changed. They're changing, right? Just to bring this back.
Yep.
The economics has changed.
Education.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yep. So we've got a lot of factors that have created instability.
That's right.
At least for our region up here.
That's right.
Right. And it's very different down south.
Yeah.
How that works in Tallahassee, Florida, or in Waycross, Georgia. A couple of places that I've been and spent time, the dynamics are totally different.
Mm-hmm.
It's wildly different. But here, that's kind of what we're dealing with.
You know, and at the same time, just to, you know, end that note on economics, we also see for the more than at any time in history, a disparity between the wealthiest and everybody else.
Yep.
And so we've never seen that kind of income inequality before. And that in and of itself is very destabilizing politically and economically and otherwise. So, so anyway, I think all of that sort of contributes to that fear and anxiety for the future.
Sure.
And that's why you see, you know, sort of this, desire. I think for many, there's sort of this desire to go back to, you know, make America great again is Trump's slogan, right?
Yeah.
And it's this idea of, you know, we had it so good, you know, two generations ago, or some people feel that way.
Yeah.
Become
the economic powerhouse and the military powerhouse and all of those, you know, concepts of greatness.
Yeah.
Right. Like you name the category in a sense of the Republican National Convention's, their top selling points of here's what we believe. He's like, all right, let's make it as big as possible and as great as possible, you know, and that mm-hmm. that's that mindset.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, again, back to this, the reality of where we're at in the 21st century is mm-hmm. we're never going to go back to 1940 or 1950 or 19...
No, not at all.
19 anything,
yeah,
right?
Things got to change. Yeah.
Things, and now, you know, we are no longer, the United States is no longer the lone superpower in the world. And, you know, we're becoming eclipsed by China. We can no longer dictate the economic terms of global trade the way that we have been able to historically. Mm. And so that's going to affect, you know, our economic conditions will continue to be, you know, changed into the future. And again, just bringing more insecurity for us here.
Yeah. Well, and I know that from the rights perspective, that, you know, they would, that those statements of, you know, we can't dictate, and this is where that, what I see the terminology being as the America first agenda, like, okay, great, global, whatever, let's just focus on us, you know, in the sense of we can control our trade agreement with China, and we can control what we can control. We can't control what's happening globally, you know, and that kind of stuff. So you see that just as, I would just say there's the difference in perspective, you know, on the right on that. So,
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So anyway, a lot of change going on and I think it's driven by fear. This reaction, generally, you know, the people see the destabilization that's happening around the country and cities all over.
It's good.
And it's,
It's not good, but the point's good.
Yeah. We're at this crescendo of, oh my gosh, the whole world's freaking out, right?
Yep.
What am I going to do? What's my family going to do? What's my community going to do? So, you know, and there's this, you know, kind of American individualism and that is unique to us. You know, let me actually interject one other little thing here too, because I think this is really relevant. I just listened to this YouTube clip of Andrew Sullivan a few days ago.
Yeah.
He's a philosopher and educator and a Brit who's now U.S. citizen, but talking about free speech.
Yeah.
And he was kind of, you know, talking about what's happening, you know, sort of in America right now, but really stepping back and looking at it in terms of the whole scale of human history and talking about how, you know, there has always been, he was talking about identity and identity politics and how, there's always been this pressure to form a group, and your power comes from the group, and if you get outside of the group, then you get ostracized.
Yeah,
and so that is, you know, it's always like built into our DNA as humans. We're social creatures.
Yeah,
to like find our group.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, coalesce around our group, and then it's all about the group.
You better believe
it. And through the group, we have power. We have political power. We have economic power.
Hey man, welcome to super PACs. Welcome to, you know, I mean, you name any arena of government, media, whatever, we tribalize. I mean, we just do it naturally. Right. And I think our brains are actually built for it. You know, our brains are built to have pattern recognition, right? So that's just how our brains work. Right. We're always looking for patterns. Like somebody somebody does something to you and the same person does it to you again, third time, you expect it, right? You've now created a bias, right? And so that those things are so naturally ingrained in our brains. What we miss, what I feel like we miss is the filtering process. Mm-hmm. What do we use to filter the biases that we come into, you know, finding a group, right? You know, how do we, what are the filters that we're using? And I think, you know, ultimately that's the biggest question happening is determining what filters am I going to use moving forward?
Yeah.
You know, for, defeating a so the concept of racism, and bigotry, is something that is been eternal and always been there. Like it's just part of human history. We've never found a utopia. that was able to rid themselves. Everyone that's tried ended up either, if you look on the communistic side, it's ended in murder, or you know, on certain things. And in the capitalism model, you have groups like the African Americans that were enslaved to make other people rich. So, you know, you've got this whole broad history to say, okay, bias is something that seems like we're always going to be dealing with. What I believe now is like the upper level thinking, like okay, mm-hmm. so we have bias, but okay, what's the upper level is now I can actually look at that bias and go, oh, maybe morally I shouldn't have that bias. Mm. Maybe socially that bias isn't working for me or them.
Yeah.
And maybe practically it just doesn't work either. You know, so I mm-hmm. think that's ultimately where the conversation is going to be heading, hopefully, to create solutions mm-hmm. To the issues that are plaguing communities, is to recognize, okay, we're all going to have some bias, but mm-hmm. we need to filter it differently. So go ahead.
Well, yeah, and to kind of finish my thought there. So yeah. the other thing that's at play here, though, and, mm-hmm. and this is what Andrew Sullivan was talking about,
right.
is that in the 17th century, we had the experiment that mm-hmm. became, you know, America.
Yep.
And really, for the first time in human history, there was this idea of celebrating the individual,
mm-hmm.
And that individual autonomy, that the individual could have political power, mm-hmm. that the individual could have economic power,
mm-hmm.
And through, you know, the United States and the U.S. Constitution and ultimately the Bill of Rights, and
yep.
all of those were a celebration of the individual and individual power, an individual against the whole state, mm-hmm. you know, in many cases.
Yeah.
And so this is sort of a relatively new kind of human idea.
It is.
And yet here we are at this time in history where we have both of these ideas kind of challenging each other.
Uh-huh.
What's more important, the individual? Uh-huh. You know, is it more important for me to say what I want to say and, you know, carry my gun in public and, you know, et cetera? Or
yeah.
is it more important yeah. for me to, or is it, you know, is forming my group identity and, you know, accessing my power through that group identity, is that sort of where I get political and uh-huh. power and
yeah.
find, you know, find security.
Uh-huh.
And so those two ideas are uh-huh. at play right now,
they
right?
are. Absolutely.
And I think mm-hmm. that's part of what's going on right now too.
Yeah, I totally agree with you.
And I think, you know, the challenge with that is that, you know, and I, you know, I look at both and I'm, well, both make sense, right?
Uh-huh.
And I think that is an amazing thing about what we've developed here in this, you know, American project
uh-huh.
is this idea of individualism.
Uh-huh.
And individual power and you know, equality under the law,
yeah,
individual protections, individual rights.
Mm-hmm.
And here we come back now full circle.
Yep.
Is there is a responsibility that we have in a democratic society,
mm-hmm.
If we want to have, you know, a society that really is equal and fair for all and
yep.
Equal opportunity.
Yeah.
For, you know, both political and economic
yeah.
power.
Yeah.
And it requires a certain amount of self-responsibility.
Of course.
And a certain amount of, you know, just good behavior.
Right.
How else can I
yeah.
say it, right? And,
yeah.
you know, well, what, and a perfect example of that, so with George Floyd, I mean, that's an example of where, you know, the state has failed us. And even with the laws that we have in place,
yeah.
We do have institutionalized racism in this okay. country that does need to be addressed.
Mm-hmm.
And incidents like that
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. bring it to our attention that this is a real thing. This
mm-hmm.
is happening in our country.
Yeah, I'll tell you, this is one of those sticking issues on the right around the concept of institutionalized racism.
Mm-hmm.
And what I hear happening is just how we define terms.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, somebody says systemic or institutionalized racism, they immediately think of the institution itself. And they go, okay, show me the law where there's racism. Well,
mm-hmm.
that's all been removed. So there's no laws on the books that promote racism. Because if they were, they'd be gone, right? Like our society won't tolerate it. generally, we won't allow for there to be a specific laws. Since they outlined redlining in 1970, whatever, with the Fair Credit Act and the, you know, and some of those things. So mm-hmm. it's been a process to get there. But okay, so on the right, they go, okay, well, there's no laws talking about institutional, you know, racism, in that the institutions are in itself racist, which you have our individuals in the institutions who have bias and racism and are dealing with that. And then you look at, okay, well, here's what the data says, right? So we look at the systemic, right. Which I think systemic is more looking at institutional racism. The right automatically will run to the law mm-hmm. and go, legally, that's not there. Doesn't exist. Okay. Mm-hmm. So then when we talk about systemic, well, that's a little bit more amorphous term. It doesn't have clarity, you know, as far as what it could mean, because if systemic, it's just everywhere. It's kind of in everything. And so then you look at the history mm-hmm. of the African-American community, and you look at the process that they've been in, you go, okay, so literally 50 years has gone since a lot of that institutionalized racism was removed. It's been 50 years. I think we forget how short this has been.
Yeah.
And how long does it take for a culture of individuals who've been within a system to discover their voice, to discover their capacity with what we would now on the conservative side, you would say now everyone's on an even playing field, right? Like, okay, so all the barriers have been removed, but we don't see what culturally is happening within those communities that had to find out how to survive mm-hmm. in institutional That's right. racism. And so you've got generational things that are happening. That's right. You have a whole slew of things that are going on. And so the idea that there's no systemic racism, I think, is just on its face ridiculously false. Right. Just mm-hmm. I think just from just if you just pick apart what I just said, yeah. like, OK, there's this big there are these bigger issues. Mm-hmm. So I talk to my friends. I have the honor of preaching in black churches. I've had the honor of preaching to a group of churches that gather that were black churches and white churches in the Deep South, bringing them together and doing racial reconciliation mm-hmm. services where we're able to take ownership of the generational issues. Not the individual mm-hmm. issue, right? Because we all have blind spots. Like, we all yeah. need to recognize we got blind spots and we need to deal with those. And so we need to deal with that and what's in our hearts. But then we also can try and bring some healing to an entire community through recognizing and humbling ourselves and going, okay, there's some generational things here. Mm-hmm. And so even in that process,
yeah.
you know, being able to do that, it's very difficult for people who haven't seen it or experienced it or been around it to understand what that actually means. Mm-hmm. And this goes back to the concept of the media. Mm-hmm. Because I think the reason why there's people downtown with ARs and guns is because they're getting a nonstop feed of negative reports of rioting, looting, and that these people are that, like, there was a peaceful protest, which I don't think anybody's upset or mad at peaceful protests for Black Lives Matter. I don't see that being a large issue. Mm-hmm. You're always going to have a couple people that are going to have problems with it. So, but then there's the agitation piece and the rioting and the looting. And I think that kind of like, oh, I better be on red alert. So I think mm-hmm. that's just driven, mm-hmm. the, you know, what's the thing that the media, the most powerful tool the media has is fear to sell whatever they're selling, right? Because if it was like you only had good news on the media, if that's all you had on every news channel was just good news all day, they wouldn't sell much.
You must be watching the Bonner Breakdown.
Come on, giddy up. Good report. So I said a lot. Yeah. That was a huge mouthful.
Yeah.
But no, I just felt like you know, dealing with this institutionalized racism piece mm-hmm. Here in North Idaho, we don't see it. Especially if you were raised here and you live here, you don't see it. Mm-hmm. You're only going to see what comes across on the screen mm-hmm. for what's happening in areas, because we are not a diverse community.
That's right. And, you know, and that's, I want to segue here a little bit and talk about, that's why I was so inspired to see these kids stand
sure.
up
okay.
and speak out for Black Lives Matter. And you know, we've had BLM protests here in mm-hmm. Sandpoint before,
mm-hmm.
But they weren't that large, and they weren't, you know, repetitive, you know, through the week. And so what I see that's different this time around is an extraordinary level of youth engagement.
Mm-hmm.
And I see young people not taking their cues from, you know, parents or anyone else. They mm-hmm. are taking the initiative to come together
mm-hmm.
and stand up and speak out on, mm-hmm. on an issue that they're passionate about. Mm-hmm. And even though, to your point, they don't directly see it in their community.
Yeah.
You know, but yeah. yet they see that this is an issue in our society, yeah. and this is their world that they're going to be inheriting, mm-hmm. and they want to have an impact, and they want to live in a better world tomorrow. So
yeah,
I'm really good. Inspired by that,
yeah.
and
yeah.
and that gives me hope, and it makes me think that that we could actually get somewhere
yeah.
with this, and somewhere that's in a more enlightened place than where we are today.
Mm-hmm.
That feels ultimately feels safer and more equitable for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm really hopeful for that.
Yeah. So there is a contingent of people that live up here who have felt like the focus on Black Lives Matter, whether it was the murals and under the bridge or in different places, where they felt like the focus on those protests and even your commentary that you put out there on Wednesday was by nature divisive, by you're trying to divide people into identity politics and into different groups. What are your thoughts on that? I mean, I see that happening. I watched that. I just would love to get your, what do you think? What's yeah. kind of your take on that? Because, you know, regardless of whether or not that's valid or not, some people are feeling that way. So I'm just yeah. kind of curious what you're.
No, you're right. And I recognize that too. That is what some people see.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I think what's kind of strange about that is, two things. One, you know, you have, if we're to look at this, in a polarized way and, mm-hmm. you know, say we've got, yep. okay, you've got the, you know, one group that's, pro Second Amendment and, you know, if we take them at their word, you know, their intent is to protect their community
right.
and, yep. And even protect, First Amendment speech. And then the other group, you know, they are wanting a society that is that treats people of color fairly mm-hmm. under the law,
mm-hmm.
and you know that group too. You know, we have this situation where we do have you know this is interesting. Let me diverge
yeah,
here
yeah,
for one
go
moment
for it,
because
man.
If you were to what I think is interesting is those two groups that have some things in common.
Absolutely. They have things in common.
I want to focus yeah. on that a little
yeah.
bit because, you know, I would say that both groups, would have a complaint that, that the state has a monopoly on violence. And that's why people, show up with their AR-15s down on First Avenue because either they don't trust or they don't have faith that that the police are going to be able to get
that
the job
was my
done.
First thought
right
that was when I saw that my first thought oh they do not trust that the police are going to be able to do their job
that's right
that was yeah. my like oh they're clearly they need to be the ones to take care of it
and nope. what are the Black Lives Matter protesters protesting
the police
fact that the police are not doing their job
yep yeah
so
yeah the irony is not lost yeah yeah
yeah
yeah
So I think that's really important to lead with. And this is not, you know, and I'm just kind of, you know, as an elected official, mm-hmm. I feel like I'm kind of in the middle of this and I can, you know, see both sides. And I think that we're very fortunate in this community to have an excellent police force that
uh-huh.
has the privilege of
uh-huh.
having all the training that many of these protesters are calling for around the nation. Things like automatic police cameras, mm-hmm. all of our officers have had for years now, which is something that other protesters in cities across the nation are calling for.
Yep.
So, and a lot of the de-escalation training, the mental health training. So all of these things, and even the defunding police movement, which when I first heard that, I'm like, what is this about, right? And then, you know, when I learned a little bit more about it, I'm like, oh, well, there it does make sense. And I see it firsthand, man, the stuff that we put on the police.
Explain more.
Okay.
Explain more.
So defunding the police is you know, it's oversimplified. I'm going to put it like this. It's this idea of we are putting too much responsibility on the police and asking them to be specialists in too many different areas.
Okay.
And so we hire, you know, somebody with a gun and we, you know, put them through police training. And then, you know, if they're lucky, they get some extra training here or there to focus on, you know, de-escalation training, mental health training, these kinds of things.
Yep.
But, medical. You know, we ask them to do everything from, you know, deliver, you know, to respond to calls that they maybe just don't have. Maybe it needs to be a social worker that needs to go to that call. Maybe it needs to be a mental health worker. Maybe it, you know, needs to be. You know, most often what's most needed in most situations are, is like de-escalation training, right? In any kind of violent situation. Yeah. And then or many times
just it's negotiation training.
Right. And then many times it's just like, you know, dog barking or, you know, there's a tree that fell on the sidewalk or this kind of stuff, which is, you know, you don't need somebody with a gun to respond to that stuff, you know? So we're asking police to do everything for everybody all the time. And yet nobody can have all those skills and, you know, and they get, you know, and they, you know, I think we pay them well, but I don't think we can pay them enough for what we ask them to do. You know?
Absolutely. And the cost.
That's right.
The mental, emotional, physical risk that they take is, I don't think most people can grasp.
Right.
Unless especially, you've been in a police family or anything like you just don't see, you can't tell.
Especially in this toll. Day and age, I think, with
absolutely.
The degree of you know, political tension that we see in our society when you've got...
I wish that when people come up with a slogan, they would get the words right. Because defund is the wrong word. I understood totally what... Like, I had to study it. Like, okay, what in the world are they talking about? Yeah. Because you got all of a sudden the media's like, they're not... They don't mean defund the police. They don't mean... And I'm like, come on. Like, use your words. Like, come up with the right language. Because if you're going to say diversify police resources...
Yeah.
Okay. That makes sense. Defund means get rid of police.
Yeah.
You know, so I think that like I one of the things that drives me nuts right now in the conversation in general is that we just the people who are coming up with these slogans, whether they're radicals and then they like somebody like it's a radical like get rid of all the police agenda, which is out there, right? And I can't say that that doesn't exist. It's there. But then the reasonable people go, oh, wait, that okay, we can't do that. We want progress. We can't do that. So then they redefine the term, but they won't actually change the name of the term. You know, so that stuff drives me nuts because guess what? When 90% of people are reading through the news, they're seeing clickbait. They're seeing things that say defund the police and look how atrocious this is. Look how evil this is. Okay, so, but what does it actually mean? You know, so very few people will go past stage one of outrage and they'll just stick there.
So can I share one example of how we have already done that as Sandpoint Police Department?
Okay.
You probably are surprised to hear this.
All right. Great. Okay. Well, let's do it.
So we created the code community resource officer division a couple years ago, right?
Yep.
And so that was very much the idea is we have two officers currently and, you know, they don't carry guns, but they're community resource officers. They are the ambassadors between the city and particularly the police department and the community. And so, you know, they're out there enforcing, again, things like right-of-way violations or, you know, business licenses or dog, you know, calls for dog, you know, problems or whatever, that kind of stuff. And so they're just sort of, you know, boots on the ground, sort of, you know, take care of everything. And it doesn't require an armed officer to respond to that call. And so, so that actually, you know, makes our police department run much more efficiently.
Okay.
It creates better relations with the community, between the police force and the community. And it actually reduces our cost, you know, in terms of budget for the police department. So, so that's one example of one of the things that, that we've done. And And you know, we can go further with that. It is more challenging, I think, for a small city police department.
Totally.
You know, we've only got a staff of 20.
Well,
so.
And you know what's beautiful is that as a city, as a municipality, you guys get to make the choices on how you want to move forward in allocation of resources, mm-hmm. right? And that debate gets to happen within the city. The debate gets to happen locally.
That's right.
And I think that's how it's supposed to be. You know, I think local governance is key to a thriving community and getting involved and, yeah. and taking care of that stuff.
I want to go back to your previous
I was about to go back to you. Yeah,
okay.
So go ahead.
So, because we were talking about what these two groups have in common,
yeah.
and this is for me the most ironic, is this idea of anti-fascism. And so we go back 80 years, and here the United States of America, along with, you know, the rest of the Western bloc, mm-hmm. mm-hmm. was in a fight against fascism, mm-hmm. right?
Yep, and it's many varied forms.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And, you know, we were all proud of our American idealism, mm-hmm. and if you were to go around, you know, saying that you were a fascist on the streets in, you know, the 1940s or 50s, I don't want to know what would have happened to you. Nobody would know what would have happened to you,
but
it wouldn't have been good.
It'd be bad.
It wouldn't have been good.
Yep.
And so here somehow we've done a complete 180, you know, two generations, three generations later. And now the idea of, you know, sort of bashing the anti-fascist, like this movement against anti-fascism is like, well, wait a minute. So we all have to be pro-fascist now? Is that what we're doing? And
I have some interesting thoughts on that.
Yeah. And
okay.
I think that
I'm going to adjust my seat.
Yeah. Right. So I think that that's one area where these two groups, if they actually sit down and talked about it, and maybe I'm wrong. Maybe the 2A group, maybe they really are pro-fascist, but my sense is that
they're probably not
pro-fascist.
Not at all. Here's what I see happening. I see people who want power and control and want to create change. And anyone who stands in their way is fascist. That's like the bluntest definition of the negative view of an anti-fascist movement, is that they're fascist. In their desire to get power, we will use threat, force, control, whatever we need to do. We will. I mean, this is where anybody who's on the right and is vocally supportive of the president is considered a racist and a fascist. So. Because we have different ideologies around how, you know, how economics should work, or how to diversify the economy, or how to go about some of these things, it's turned into the word fascism. The word fascist, I think, has become the new form of calling people racist, when they really aren't racist. They maybe have some bias that they're not aware of, but they wouldn't never intentionally be racist towards anybody. But you don't agree with me on something, you're racist. I've been called racist more times in the last 3 months than I've been called since college when I was playing basketball. You know, so that was the only last time I was ever called a racist, was, you know, playing on a team with all black people, and I ended up, you know, just whooping this other kid who was black, and he called me a racist. He was so mad that he just called me a racist. And so I was like, okay, whatever. But the last 3 months I've been called racist in DMs and in text messages, for having different guests on my show, and I'm like, okay, they don't know me, you know? So I just kind of let that slide. But I think that the same thing goes for, if you have a differing political opinion, now the mantra is that you're fascist, you know? So, and I just point to this concept of, okay, what is fascism, and how is that actually being shown to be true? Okay, like how is that being played out as a true statement in word and in action, both, right? Because I can't read people's minds. Everybody seems to read Trump's mind in just an amazing way in the media. Everyone's got, you know, they've read his mail and know exactly what he's fearing and thinking and you know, like all this stuff. I don't listen to any of that because I take people at what they say and what they do. So, okay. So,
or what they tweet.
Or, well, exactly, and what they tweet. And let me tell you, I've not been real happy with what's been coming on Twitter from the president recently at all. And I've you know, been a fairly open-minded Republican, you know, when it comes to Trump and all that stuff. I've not been real happy. I'm glad he took some tweets down. He actually took some tweets down. I was like, oh, this is great. You know, finally, like, he didn't apologize for it, but that's not his MO. So, but, you know, he took some tweets down that I think were somewhat harmful. But, you know, I think that the concept of being fascist is more about political power than it is about what actual fascism is. You know, when you look at creating opportunity zones, you look at creating, you know, the concept of freedom, economic freedom, capitalism, and embracing capitalism fully is the opposite of fascism. And so it's just a little hard to wrap my head around where 2016, in the middle of the election, Glenn Beck, who's a very famous personality on the right, came out and declared Donald Trump was a fascist, right? So so that he's got these marks of, you know, his personality is on this level of persuasion is so high that, you know, he could get away with anything, and, you know, he must be, you know, made this whole thing together that he was fascist, and watched his actions over 2 years and came back and apologized and was like, I was so wrong. He's anything but fascist. Right. But, you know, when a lot of people, even on the right, were like, yeah, looks like this guy could be. But then, you know, you watch what someone actually does and how they govern and that kind of stuff, and changed a lot of people's minds. So that's my two cents on from the right side perspective on the fascist thing. You know, you don't see any, you got, of course, you've got some militant groups on the right, but you don't see them usually going out, and I think there's one, right? The Proud Boys, that would go out and fight with the anti-fascist people. Most people on the right are like, yeah, do whatever. You want to have your, you know, you want to have your protest, you want to have your thing, you want to call people whatever, great. They don't, you know?
Yeah.
So it's kind of more open.
That may be their intent. Okay, so now we go great. Full Perfect. Circle back to yep. intent and impact, because here we go back to last Tuesday.
Mm-hmm.
And the impact
yeah.
of having, you know, that many guns down on our streets that showed up for a peaceful protest,
mm-hmm.
predominantly high school students. And I'm going to just set aside sort of there were overt actions of intimidation and harassment, which is
unacceptable,
and unacceptable.
Absolutely.
But I'm going to just like set that aside, because that was just part of what happened.
Right.
But I'm just going to talk about just the idea of having, you know, 50 assault yeah. rifles down on First Avenue, just in and of itself. Mm-hmm. Right. Even if those people, you know, had the purest intent and, you know, were nothing but respectful to the sure. protesters
yep.
And to the business owners, et cetera. And the impact of that,
mm-hmm.
and this comes back to, again, you know, just this idea of being, you know, a good citizen,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And while I understand, you know, those people were responding to a perceived fear or threat, they were responding out of fear to a perceived threat, you know, that I kind of have a hard time with, because that to me is pretty absurd when, you know, given just when you look at what that threat was on its face, it's like, really? Come on. Yeah. Is that what you yeah. believe? But I'm going to just put that aside too, and okay. just look at it for, you know, what it was. And having gone around and I've spoken to as many of downtown business owners as I could, I spoke to the protesters there. I watched the interaction between the protesters and the armed people, and what's been obvious to me is that the impact of that you know, armed citizenry downtown was it was oppressive, it was intimidating, it created fear within mm-hmm. the customers
it's a
as well
clash.
As the, that's right. Mm-hmm. But the reality that like there's a difference here because the effect is, and so now I when I go around and I talk to these business owners like and customers, they don't want to say anything. Why don't they want to say anything? I know why they don't want to say. They've told me why they don't want to say anything. Mm-hmm. They're afraid mm-hmm. that there will be backlash. Mm-hmm. That if they say something, that they will be further intimidated.
Mm-hmm.
They will be targeted. Mm-hmm. They these groups will come and mm-hmm. literally like you know camp mm-hmm. out in front of their business mm-hmm. with their guns. So this is like the worst nightmare for mm-hmm. for any downtown business owner.
Wow.
Right.
Wow.
So and this
well, that's super helpful feedback. Because that's one of the things that I think whenever there is intimidation and people feel intimidated, one of the last things that they do is tell people.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost the last thing that people do is go, I'm intimidated. I'm afraid something's going to happen.
That's right.
So that's good to say it. You know, it's good to bring that forward because people that have a good intent might not understand their impact.
Right. And, you know, to say it another way. When I saw these, you know, I was kind of in the middle of the march and the kids sort of coming around, they were coming off the bridge
mm-hmm.
and they were going under the bridge and coming around the corner. And so I'm just a little bit behind the front of the group of kids and they come around the corner and they see a group of armed men up in front of them on the trail. And I could just see them, you know, like it was like they hit an invisible wall and stopped and started to turn around. And I could just see the fear, right? They were afraid to walk into this, you know, group of armed men. And you know, at that point I, you know, ran to the front of the line and like, come on kids, we got this, you know, kind of, you know, cheered them on.
Mm.
And they, you know, they turned around and they continued on. But that was again an example of subtly what's going on here. This is a power dynamic.
It is.
You've got
absolutely
you've got a group with you know that's armed and yeah. whether they think they're being intimidating or not, whether they think they're being oppressive or not, that's the effect.
Yeah.
Because you know and the reality is, you know, that group can say, oh well you should just, you know, get over it.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Well that's like try using that in your marriage.
Yeah.
Right.
Doesn't work well.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's really good. I, you know, for me, just personally, you know, I think that there is, because there is a lack of conversation, like what we're having,
mm-hmm.
you know, I would say I lean pretty far right. And I think you lean a little more to the left. That's what everybody says. That's what they print in the paper. I've never heard it from your mouth, but you know, that's kind of the concept, you know, like, okay, you know, lean left. And there's not many forums where we can dialogue and then give each other honest feedback. I love like, you know, I love spending time with you just because we get to have these conversations. And what's great is that you've given me really honest feedback to say, I think that's full of crap, right? Like, yeah, but I don't buy that. And, you know, you and I are able to have these conversations because I believe that there's a level of openness because I think we value each other as people. You know, I'm assuming that, you know, but the reality is that, I think that if there was a way to remove, I know we gotta shut this down, but if there's a way to remove some of the accusation on the right and mm-hmm. remove accusation on the left, if we can begin to dial back the accusatory language towards each other, I think that we can begin to enter into an actual dynamic of developing real solutions. And that's my heart, you know, mm-hmm. is like, okay, like I feel really strongly on some topics. You feel really strongly on some topics. And yet at the same time, because there's the human value, right? And mm-hmm. and we're able to have these conversations, hopefully in a way to create solutions and say, where can we find agreement? Like, I don't think the fascist thing's a thing that's one of those things where I think there's just very, very different perspective about what Antifa stands for mm-hmm. on the right versus what people might think it stands for on the left. So, okay, well, let's define terms.
Mm-hmm.
Let's come up with common language. Let's make sure we're yeah. talking about the same things because, right. you know, and that's a process. It's not a, not a one-time deal. So everybody needs to calm down on Facebook and talk to some people. Mm-hmm. There you go. That's all my, right. There's my 2 cents.
So I appreciate that.
Yeah. Yep. Anything else?
I got a question for you.
Yeah, go for it.
So, and this is getting political now.
Great.
You don't mind if we go there?
No, I really don't. After the episode of getting canceled for doing nothing, I figured I might as well do something. So go ahead.
Fair enough. What did you think? You know, there's been a number of very prominent leaders in mm-hmm. our country, and mm-hmm. many of them on the right, mm-hmm. who've come out, in opposition, vocal mm-hmm. opposition against mm-hmm. Trump in the mm-hmm. last week.
Yeah.
And one of the most significant for me was James Mattis, mm-hmm. Secretary of Defense and four-star Marine general.
Yeah.
50-year career.
That's
in the Marines.
Yeah. And he's got a little military clout.
Yeah, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you know, not just, I mean, it was like a very powerful statement, uh-huh. I thought.
Yeah.
And I did something that I've never done before. I actually opened the last council meeting, reading his statement.
Okay.
And it's in almost 4.5 years now. It's the first time that I mentioned Trump's name.
This is probably smart. Probably smart. It's a divisive arena. Here's what I'll say about that. I listened to the Attorney General Bill Barr, who was an Attorney General in the 80s, talk about the whole process of Lafayette Park and some of the things that Mattis was upset about. Mm-hmm. Mattis wasn't in the room. That's my first thing. Like, he wasn't in the room. He's hearing secondhand, thirdhand reporting. For the people who are in the room, nobody disagreed. Everybody was on the same page. For the people who are in the room, whether it's Mark Esper, Bill Barr, or Trump, or the vice president, or these people who are having the conversation about potential military National Guard, when do we use them? When is it appropriate to use them? And they were all in agreement. That's the absolute last resort. And let's lean on the locals to make sure and like give them the support that they need. Let's let them make the request. We won't force it. And the reporting that came out about that was that it was the exact opposite, that Trump's like gung-ho send the military and everybody's like, no, dude, you're crazy. Well, everyone else who was in the room in that conversation all said the exact opposite. So that's where I go, okay, great letter from Mattis if it was true. But then I go, okay, wait, so Mattis wasn't in the room and he's hearing this from whatever sources. And obviously that's happened over and over and over and over and over, especially in the Trump administration, right? You got anonymous source here, anonymous source there. So there's all this craziness surrounding every report that comes out. So I always go to, okay, who is in the room? What are they saying? Because I always want firsthand testimony to what's actually being said or heard. Now, it could be this total where they're just all lying flat out about what's being said, but I have to intentionally read their mind and vilify their character to do that. And I didn't do that with Obama or any of the people in his administration when things were kind of like, what is happening? I'm getting all these crazy reports. Oh, what was said in the room? Okay, I'll believe that. Mm. And that's just how I've learned to operate with media. So that's my 2 cents on that. Mm-hmm. I thought it was a powerful letter, but then I'm like, okay, wait, we get very conflicting reports from the people in the room.
Well, Lafayette aside, I mean, that was one component in the letter, but it was a much broader statement about where we are at as a country.
Yeah.
And it was
Trump a powerful, good letter. Leader. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm just curious. For me, it was really impactful.
Mm.
George Bush came out and made
mm-hmm.
a statement that was uncharacteristic of
mm-hmm.
him as well.
Mm-hmm.
And
but here's where I'm like, but the operation is based on. So we've got, I know we got to wrap up, but we have a hyperbole in chief. So this guy masters in hyperbole and trying to use simple terms to persuade people. That's his MO. And so he'll make simple statements that people can take 1,000 different ways. And that is a problem. When you're the president of the United States, it's very effective for your brand, maybe, and it's very effective to let people think whatever they want to think when you're selling something, but he's in a different role. So I always take that into context when he makes these kind of bold statements. And so to the point of the bold statements, absolutely, I felt like based on some of the hyperbole that Trump was using, along with the different reporting and all the narrative that came out, based on what was coming out, I don't think George Bush was off in his comment. I don't think Mattis was off in his comment. I think in fact, like, some of the principles and the things that were being talked about from Mattis was really strong. But then I go, okay, but I'm always like, okay, what's actually happening? Like, what's actually being said? So I always step back even from that stuff. I'm very reticent to believe any report, left, right, anything, just because I keep, every time I dig, I find something different than what was reported. And I'm not trying to be too conspiracy theorist. I'm not like, it's all fake news, but there is a lot of that. And you know, I see it on a huge amount on every major network. There's not a single one that I'm not like, oh my gosh, they tell the truth all the time. It just doesn't happen. So, and you and I have had that conversation. So,
well, Chris, it has certainly been a pleasure.
I know, we got to go. Today. We got to go. So, and maybe we do it again.
Yeah. Yeah. Look forward to it.
Yeah. And I'm just, so that you know, I think I'm praying that you have wisdom as a leader in the city and in their area and how you handle all this stuff, you know, says this is not easy.
I appreciate
it. No matter where you sit, is not easy.
Yeah.
You know, there's no instant solutions to this. These problems, these issues. And so, you know, hopefully you can make good choices in your process.
I appreciate that.
Yeah. Thank awesome. You. All right. Well, that was a riveting episode of the Bonner Breakdown. And, we are hopeful that, you will like, share, subscribe, follow, click all the bells, hit all the whistles, all the buttons, all the extra things, and have a wonderful day. And feel free to leave your comments. Be respectful. That's all I ask. All right. Have a good day. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for watching today's episode. Please like, follow, share, and subscribe on all of our social media platforms at Bonner Breakdown. And you can also support this show to provide more of these types of conversations at patreon.com/Bonner Breakdown.